Sunshine and Smiles by Bud Robinson, Section 1, Life's Story, Chapter 1, Earliest Recollections. I moved to America on January 27, 1860. I met a cold reception, of course, as the snow was something like knee-deep, and I was very thinly clad, just having the suit that nature provided for me. I settled in White Country, Tennessee. My first employment was to work for my living, and my mother said I was a good rustler, but I used up my income as fast as I got it. If it were not that God was to have the glory, I never want to tell of the poverty or ignorance or hardships I've waded through. I expect that when I've been in heaven a week, I'll forget I ever went barefooted in this country. Right where the devil had his den, there shall be a palace of flowers. The redeemed shall walk on the highway of holiness. Out of the 1,189 chapters in the Bible, the 35th chapter of Isaiah comes nearer being my experience than any I can find. I have read them all on my knees and on my feet, sitting down and standing up and lying down. I have read them by sunshine and by moonshine and by electricity and by lamplight. I have never been so poor that I did not have sunshine and moonshine a part of the time, but I have been too poor to buy kerosene oil, and I had to study by moonshine when I studied by night. I have studied the Bible by moonshine, lying in the yard face downward. I'd rather do that than not to read it at all. There is so much in it that if a man has not the time to read it by sunshine, is too poor to buy oil, he ought to thank God for moonshine. Get out into the yard and read it. The man who wants to go to heaven has the way open to go, and men and devils can't hold him. Glory to God. Now I see the real leadings of God all along the line. There were a number of years that he seemed to be hid from me. But I did want to do right at all times, but I have realized the last few years that God is real near. When I got the consent of my mind to let him save me, he was there to save me. I was born in the mountains of Tennessee in the very lowest depths of poverty, in an old log cabin without any chimney to it, only a mud chimney about halfway to the top, a dirt floor and one room in the house, and but little furniture. No cook stove, no sewing machine in it, nothing of the kind, no bookcase nor wardrobe, no carpets of any kind, but simply the face of the earth. But that is not a bad place to be born, especially if a fellow does not intend to do anything after he is born. There is where I was born, in that log cabin. Such a thing as schools and churches were unknown there on the mountains where I was born. It matters little how my life starts, if it ends with a chariot and some angels. I started out in poverty, and my father was unfortunately in the whiskey business. When a man gives his time to ruining men, it don't take long to go to the bottom. I was hungry and cold, and slept on a sheepskin with a dog often. I didn't know there was such a thing as a church or a schoolhouse in the world. I've had people to make fun of me all my life, but why didn't you come and help me? My baby buggy was not a carriage, but a hollow log, about 4 feet long, split open, making a nice little trough, with an old quilt in it and a pillow. I spent several months as happy as a lark. My mother sat by me and carded wool and cotton rolls to spin her thread. As mother sat there by the old log fire and sung the sweetest old songs in the world, I had nothing to do but lie there in the little cradle, as it was called, and listen to mother sing, play with my hands, suck my thumb, and go to sleep. As mother carded, she rocked the cradle with her foot and looked down into the trough and talked all kinds of baby talk to me, and said many a time that little Buddy was sure to make his mark in this world. Well, my friends, I want to stop long enough to tell you I made the mark. It was a long, black, crooked one. The hope of the race is the confidence a mother puts in her children. Every true mother can see something in her boy that other people can't see. The reason we can't see something in them is because they are not our boys. The reason she does is because he is her boy. She looks beyond his misfortunes and sees him in great possibilities, and in her heart, full of love, she knows that success is sure to come. With a smile of hope on her face, she sees fortune just ahead. By this time, you are anxious to know whether or not the baby boy ever got out of the hollow log. Of course he did. Don't you know that you can't keep a boy forever in a hollow log? I told you at the start that the log was only 4 feet long. I soon outgrew it, and Mother had to put breeches on me and turn me loose with the other children. About this time in life, recollection came into use. The first thing I remember was the soldiers going by with the blue coats on. The next thing was my mother coming through the cornfield shouting. She was coming from the spring that was over at the back of the little cornfield. It was one of those beautiful springs flowing out from under the great mountain, as clear as crystal and so cold it would make your teeth ache, just running over the white sand and gravel, sun perch, red bass, and speckled trout, playing under the rocks that stuck out over the branch, all covered with ferns and mountain moss. Surely that was one of the prettiest places in the world, and while Mother was over there getting water, the same Christ that met the woman at the well met Mother. And while she was filling her bucket with water, the Lord filled her soul with grace, and she came through the field with her bucket in one hand, waving the other over her head, praising the Lord. Occasionally she would set the bucket down and go to clapping her hands and shouting in the old style, it was glory, glory, hallelujah, bless God forever. We children ran out and climbed up on the yard fence where we could see Mother's head as she jumped up and down in the cornrows. She came onto the house bareheaded and spilt nearly all the water and lost her bonnet, but she had a shine on her face I never will forget. I was at that time about 4 years old, and Mother's shouting put me under such deep conviction I had no rest from the sense of guilt and condemnation. I wanted religion worse than anything in the world. I well remember going down into the apple orchard, getting down on my knees under an old horse apple tree to pray. I don't know why I didn't get religion, unless it was because of the wickedness of my father. He was very profane and would come in the house and swear bitterly. This would excite me very much, and for the time being I would forget the struggles of my poor little heart. The earliest recollections of my father are when he was in a difficulty and was trying to kill one of his neighbors. He had his gun in his hand, and a man was holding him to hinder him from carrying out his intentions. There are pictures that remain in the child's memory like burrs in a sheep's wool. The next one that took fast hold of mine was a difficulty between Mother and a Yankee soldier. My father had been run off from home and all the horses taken but one old sorrel mare with a blazed face and one eye out, old Jen, we called her. Mother and we children hauled wood on the sled with old Jen. One morning, Mother went out to feed her, and the Yankee soldier told her to feed that mare well, for he expected to ride her that day. Of course, the war opened right there. Mother told him never in this world would he ride old Jen. She fed the mare, and we children stayed out in the yard to see whether or not the Yankee was coming to get her. About the time old Jen finished up her breakfast, the Yankee was at the barn door with Mother and us children, and the circus opened up. He opened the barn door and went in to put the bridle on the mare, and Mother took it off. He began to curse, and Mother was shaking her fist in his face, calling him all sorts of hard names. He put the bridle on again, and Mother pulled it off. By this time, he was pretty hot, and jerked an old pistol out of his belt, and we children began to scream as loud as we could and hold Mother's dress. He swung the revolver over his head and cursed. By this time, Mother was at white heat, and hit him right over the head and face with the bridle, just as hard as she could put it on him. Then the regular fight took place. They clenched and scuffled over the barn for some little time while we children were almost having spells. Finally, he shoved Mother up against the barn door and hurt her side, and before she could regain her strength and renew the battle, he had put the bridle on old Jen and led her out of the barn and was riding away. Mother stood at the barn door, shaking her fist after him and saying in a loud voice, "You better get a good ride today, because this is the last day you'll ever ride old Jen. For if God spares my life, I will have old Please Par and the Texas Gorillas on your track before night." He laughed at her and rode on. Of course, Mother was only threatening him, as she had no idea that the Gorillas were anywhere in the country. The little squad of Yankee soldiers, about 75 in number, went up the road about 12 miles from our house on the Little Calf Killer River, stopping at a house where there was a sick woman and a lot of old women that had gathered in to wait on her. The soldiers began to exchange horses with the women without their consent, and some of them to cooking dinner for them. While they were eating, swapping horses and mistreating the old women, old Please Par and his band of Texas Gorillas came across the mountains from East Tennessee, ran upon them, and surely made it hot for the boys. Please Parr and his men fought under the black flag. They never gave nor took prisoners, and they had six shooters belted on them from their necks to their knees. I suppose the Texas guerrillas, as they were called, were among the worst men in the world. At their appearance, the bluecoats leaped into their saddles and went down the road at full speed, the guerrillas after him. Every few hundred yards, they would shoot one off his horse, and some one of the band would get down and cut off his head. By the time they had reached our place, they had killed most all the soldiers. They went by at full speed, with their horses covered with foam and dust, their mouths open, tongues out, with the sound of revolvers every minute, men hollering and pleading for their lives. What a sad day. God forbid that we should ever see another like it. As they came near our house, old Jen left the main road and turned round the corner of the field and, coming to a deep gully, tried to jump it, but failed and went head foremost into the gully right on top of the soldier that had whipped Mother that morning. The guerrillas, supposing they had killed both horse and rider, went on after the rest. After they had all passed by, the soldier got out of the gully, ran through the field, and made his escape. Mother and we children went down, got old Jen, led her to the house, bound up her limbs, carried her water, and worked with her for a week before she was sufficiently recovered from her ride to assume her duties. That soldier may have forgotten some things in his life, but there is one day's work that will never be erased from his memory. The day he whipped Mother and took old Jen and met the Texas crowd will remain fresh in his memory until he meets his black box, and all the preachers in the world will never be able to convince that fellow that Mother was not to blame for the whole affair. I think I can just see that poor man now out in the mountains that night, under a rock, raking up a few leaves to make him a bed, going to sleep about midnight, cursing rebels, and in his dreams seeing women and children, blazed-faced horses, bridles, pistols, Texas guerrillas, deep gullies, and such like. About this time in my life, my mother had a strange dream about me. She dreamed she had to offer me as a sacrifice on the altar, just as Abraham offered Isaac, and that I was to be offered for the whole family, and without it, the family would be lost. In her dream, she built the altar, bound me, and laid me on the altar, and the Lord told her to take my life. She screamed and pled with the Lord to spare me, awoke and rejoiced to find it was only a dream, went back to sleep and dreamed the same thing again. And in the last dream, she saw that all the suffering that could be put on me didn't seem to take my life, and that mine was to be a life of suffering and sacrifice, and through my suffering, the rest of the family was to be brought to Christ. This dream made a great impression on my mind. It renewed conviction and created such a desire in my heart for religion that I never could wear it off. And with all the fun, as I called it, in my life, I was never easy until the night I was converted in my 21st year. No one could persuade Mother her dream has not been fulfilled in her buddy's life. I will leave it for others who knew me to judge. Chapter 2. To Mississippi and Return. In my 5th year, the war was over. Our father had come home, sold out his land, and bought wagons and horses, and we prepared to move to Mississippi. We left the mountains of Tennessee in the fall of 1865, and just before Christmas we landed in Tipper County, Mississippi, settled on the Little Tallahassee River, where there were more fish and mud turtles, mosquitoes, and water moccasins than any place in America. We stayed in Mississippi 4 years. The first year was one of misfortune and hardship. Our horses all died with blind staggers. My father rented a farm from a man who was to furnish us teams. When the crop was planted, the man went back on his contract, and he and my father had trouble. He was a very mean man, and my father was just as mean as he. After my father lost his crop, he rented a still from a man and went to making whiskey. He did not work it that long until he and the man who owned the still had trouble, fought, and came near to killing each other. That was another dark day. By the time we were through with the whiskey business, all of our property was gone but one wagon and 2 milk cows, and now he traded the cows for a little yoke of steers and moved out into the pinery and went to burning tar for a living, which is a very hard life. There are not many boys nowadays that ever saw a tar kiln. First you go through the woods and gather up the pine knots and put them in piles, and go back over the ground with your wagon and haul your knots to the kiln, then split up your knots and build a tar kiln and burn and get the tar out. I will not go into detail and try to explain the process of burning the kiln, but it was a very hard job and the dirtiest work in the world. We were in the tar business 3 years. We generally built about 3 kilns a year and would run from 500 to 600 gallons out of the kiln and sell it for about 40 cents per gallon. It was used all over the country for axle grease, every wagon having a tar gourd hanging on the coupling pole. We spent the wet weather and Sundays hunting and fishing. The woods were full of deer and turkeys. You could hear the turkeys gobbling every morning, and often you would see a deer run across the road. We caught fish and swamp rabbits, killed snakes until we quit numbering, ate muscadines, fought mosquitoes and ticks, and I reckon had the hardest and biggest chills in Mississippi. We children passed off the time at night sitting by a big fire built of pine knots, telling riddles and chewing pine wax. At the end of our 4-year struggle, we reached the fall of 69, and with a few household goods on the old wagon and the little steers hitched to it, a big tar gourd full of tar swung in on the coupling pole, mother on the wagon with a baby on her lap and 7 other children either on the wagon or afoot playing along the road, we now bid the old Tallahassee and the swamps of the Mississippi a hearty farewell. We are now on the road for the mountains of old Tennessee again. My father walks ahead of the wagon with a musket on his shoulder. My oldest brother drives the little steers. We children ride time about 3 or 4 on the wagon, the others walking up the sandy road, playing in the sand or stopping under the chestnut trees and picking up chestnuts or climbing the fence and getting into some fellow's orchard. We would strike up camps on some little creek or at some spring a little before sundown, unyoke and feed Nig and Jerry, the little oxen, build a big chunk fire, and then we boys were up the creek with our dog in a few minutes to see if we couldn't start a rabbit. It was seek, seek, there he goes, and away Dixie would go after him. In a few moments, he runs him into a hollow tree or log. We were chopping out so quick it would make your head swim. We are now back with the rabbit, dressing him for supper. Mother brings a skillet and lid out of the wagon, puts them on the fire, and while they are heating, she brings out the cornmeal, bread tray, and sifter. Now she puts a skillet on coals of fire and proceeds to make up her bread. She sifts the meal in the big tray and makes up the dough with her hands, puts 3 nice pones in the skillet, puts on the lid, putting coals on that. She then gets the frying pan out of the wagon and goes to frying the rabbit. Now, reader, just think of it. Old-fashioned cornbread cooked in a skillet and fried rabbit for supper. My, my, I can just smell that rabbit and taste that cornbread until now. That was 34 years ago. It seems to be only yesterday. I can almost see the little creek and the old water elm standing by the ford, Dixie lying under the wagon, the little oxen having eaten their supper, lying down to rest. Now Mother brings out an old quilt or two, makes a big pallet by the fire. A dozen or more little red feet are turned to the chunk fire, and we are off to the land of dreams. About the break of day, we hear our father calling, "Boys, boys, it's time to get up and make a fire and feed the steers." So in a few minutes, we were up throwing the chunks together and shucking corn for Nig and Jerry. While Mother is getting breakfast, we cut a pole about 15 feet long and a little short fork about 3 feet long to grease the wagon with. We run one end of the long pole under the wagon, and 3 or 4 of us boys get under the other end and raise the wagon and put the little fork under to hold it up. We now get the wagon hammer and drive out the linchpin, take off the wheel and get the tar gourd off the coupling pole, and with a little paddle we put the tar on the axle and a few paddles full to the wheel to make it run light during the day, and by night you could hear it squeak 1/4 mile. The next morning we'd have to tar up again. We kept this up every morning for 3 weeks until we reached the Tennessee Mountains. I can remember as we went through Alabama in one of the little towns, 2 Negro men gave us a cursing and called us poor white trash and pretended they were going to ride over the wagon. I couldn't blame the boys much. We surely did look pretty tough, but Mother couldn't stand it. She got the old musket out of the back end of the wagon and loaded it up. She put in a handful of powder, put a wad of paper on it, and beat it down with a ramrod, then put in 16 buckshot and a little paper on that. While she was getting the box of caps, the colored boys had business up the lane. I tell you, Mother was one of the pluckiest little rebels you ever saw. Lee surrendered in 1865, but it was many years later when Mother Robinson surrendered. I think she could see blue coats and muskets in her dreams until the year Brother H.C. Morrison and Joe McCurkin held the Waco Holiness Camp Meeting, when Mother got so happy in the experience of full salvation that she lost her little black bonnet, her handbag, and her prejudice, and hasn't seen the Mason and Dixon line since. Chapter 3. Life in the Mountains of Tennessee. We reached the mountains of Tennessee just before Christmas in 1869 and settled in a little cove or valley between two great mountains. Here we made headquarters until 1876. The mountain life is a very peculiar one. A fellow has to live there to understand the situation. 30-odd years ago, the mountains surely were a rough place. We had almost as great a war in 1872 and 1873 as we did in 1862 and 1863, when Uncle Sam was setting the Negroes free. In 72 and 73, he was collecting the revenue on whiskey and brandy. You see, we mountaineers made corn whiskey for 25 cents a gallon and apple brandy for 50 cents per gallon. Of course, when Uncle Sam came in and put the revenue on corn whiskey of 50 cents and apple brandy of 75 cents per gallon, then we were only getting 25 cents for whiskey and 50 cents for brandy, he met a hostile people. There was war as soon as the first officer arrived. Those mountaineers clubbed together and got in their old log houses with their muskets and citizens' rifle. If you don't think they killed men by the hundreds, you ask Uncle Sam. Within 5 miles of our house, there were 10 stills running day and night the year round, and of course the country was flooded with whiskey. The whiskey peddlers called at our door every day, and with their ox cart loaded with whiskeys, sold it out for country produce. Chickens, eggs, corn, potatoes, or anything the people raised, we bought and used it like milk and thought it was a remedy for every disease known to the human family. A man couldn't be born, married, or die without it, and every boy in the county was drunk 2 or 3 times a week, and we thought nothing of it. From the time little boys were 10 years old, they were getting drunk. Churches or schools were almost a thing unknown at that time. Civilization had not then reached the mountains. Railroads, steam engines, buggies or carriages, and houses of lumber were things unknown in my boyhood days. Our houses were made of logs, and the cracks between were daubed with mud. Our chimneys were made of sticks and mud. The floor were made of puncheons or dirt, without a window in the house. The roofing was of oak boards, 3 or 4 feet long, split out by hand. Our hauling was done on sleds and ox carts. Our breadstuff was made at the little water mill down the creek, where we boys used to go and stay almost all day waiting for our turn, as it would take from 2 to 3 hours to grind our sack of corn. We boys would spend the time in fishing, playing marbles, or talking with the old men. Our clothing was homemade. Our mother spun and wove our clothes and made every garment we wore by hand. I was a grown man when I first saw a sewing machine. Mother wove jeans every fall to make our winter clothing, and cotton checks and cottonades every spring for shirt and pants. When we had shoes, Mother knit our socks, but we were not troubled with shoes often. I had only worn out about one pair when I was big enough to go see the girls, and the girls in the mountains of Tennessee were as bad off as we boys. They did not have their little feet all cramped up with shoe leather, so we just sparked barefoot and had no idea we needed shoes to spark in. We were all on the same platform, and such a thing as going to church or Sunday school never entered our heads. I was a man with a beard on my face the first Sunday school I ever saw. There were but few people that could read or write among the poorer people, and morality was at a very low ebb. The most of the young women were raising family without the encumbrance of a husband. It was a very common thing when it called to him to ask if you had heard that John and Sal had took up together. This was their style of matrimony. Without the expense of a license or a preacher, they just took up together. John and Sal might be a boy and girl, or perhaps a father and mother in different families that lived in the neighborhood, and they seemed to be about as well respected as anyone else. I've been in homes where the mother had 11 or 12 children, their oldest daughter 3 children, the second daughter 2, the third 1 child, and the whole family would live in from 1 to 2 little rooms made of logs with dirt floor, from 1 to 2 old bedsteads without a cooking stove. 1 or 2 chairs and an old bench constituted the furniture, but any number of neighbors were pressed to spend the night and often accepted the proffered hospitality. Someone would say, where on earth did that crowd sleep? Well now, reader, that is a secret that belongs to us mountain folks. But if you will promise never to tell anybody, I will make it so plain to you that you can never forget it. Now, did you ever throw down 4 or 5 old sheepskins in an old quilt or two and just see how many children you could put down on them? Well, you say, but what did they do for pillows? Well, now, my friend, if you go to wanting pillows, you better stay out of the mountains of Tennessee. There was but little money in circulation at that time. In fact, we did not need much money. There was little to buy in the country. The men tanned their leather and made their own shoes at home. The women made the clothing, and the people raised everything they ate. We raised corn and wheat, potatoes, cabbage, fruit, and berries in great quantities. Our hogs got fat every fall on the acorns and chestnuts in the mountains, and our possums got fat on the persimmons. We generally lived on possum most of the fall season. The young man that couldn't twist a possum out of a hollow log and dress him nice was no catch at all with the mountain girls, and the boy who had a good possum dog was considered first choice. I want the reader to remember now and forever hereafter that in my day on the old Cumberland Mountains, there was nothing in this world equal to possum and sweet potatoes. You see, we had a great big fireplace, 6 or 7 feet long, and we would roll on a great back log 2 feet through and put on a big forestick, and then pile on a big lot of little wood and just build up a log heap. We then dressed the old possum nice, put him into an old-fashioned oven, put the fire all around him, and bring in a peck of yellow yam potatoes, put them on the fire, and cover them up with hot ashes. We children would sit up, tell riddles, and play blindfold till the old possum would get done. Now, reader, just think of our satisfaction as Mother takes the lid off the oven, and we smell the possum and see him brown and juicy in the big old oven. Mother takes him out of the big dish, and we proceed to take out the potatoes. Of course, supper is now ready, and all hands go to work. We don't stop to ask a blessing. We had given thanks when we caught the possum. Supper being over, such a thing as family prayer never being heard of in our country, we had nothing to do but go to bed. We were not troubled with getting clean sheets and pillow slips. We just bring a sheepskin out of the corner, spread it out before the fire, and lie down. And in a few minutes, we were in the land of delight, and dreaming some of the finest things that ever passed through the mind of a mountain boy. About this time in my life, an impression was made on my mind I never forgot. I went to spend the night with a little boy who had a religious home. I had never been in a religious home. This was a good man, and his home was a religious one, and they had plenty to eat, nice white linen tablecloth on the table, and plenty of dishes. He asked a blessing at the table, and he helped the plates of his wife and children. He helped me. I had never seen anything of that kind before. After supper, we played blindfold and popped corn, roasted potatoes, and ate apples, and had a fine time until bedtime. The father then told the children it was time for bed, and then he told them all to sit down quietly. And he took down an old book from the shelf, and he talked out of it a long time. I did not know what he was at, as I had never seen a family worship in my life. All got down on their knees, and I knelt with them. The father talked just like he loved everybody, and I knew that he was talking to the Lord, and after he had talked to him a while about his wife and all of his children, he began to talk to him about me. I was so glad I was there, and that he was talking to the Lord about me, and many things I never will forget. He asked the Lord to help me, and to take care of me, and put his arms around me, and make me a blessing to my home and to the world. It touched my little heart. I said right then that when I got to be a man, I was going to have me a nice home, a wife and children, and I would be kind to my wife and children, and ask a blessing at the table, and read the Bible, and pray, and let my children eat apples, play, and have a nice time in my home. Well, I thank God I've lived to see that desire that sprung up in my heart fulfilled. While I am writing, two of the sweetest babies on earth are playing around me and pulling on my coat skirts and saying, Papa, come and swing me. And their mama looks on and smiles. Now, it seems so sad to me to go from this home of kindness and family prayers back to our old log cabin and hear nothing but cursing and quarreling. But such was my fate. That was in 1872. In that year, my father died, leaving mother in the mountains with 10 children, but few friends and no money. Bless her old soul, I don't see how she lived and kept the children alive, but I remember now she would spin all day and then weave until midnight. My father had been in the whiskey business. He had squandered his fortune, wrecked his life, and mother's heart was broken, and we were started in the wrong direction. Of course, there is nothing worse than a home wrecked by whiskey. The man loses all his friends, and his wife and children are without friends and without money, without education, or without anything that would commend them to the world, only their need. I have had many people make fun of me for the way I was brought up. They never did tell me how to find Jesus, nor how to get shoes when I was barefooted. So life was a drudge and a burden from the first of my recollections. By the time I was 12 years old, my whole family had gone into the lowest life in the world. My oldest brothers were getting drunk every week, and my two sisters were in bad company two or three nights in the week. Our old cabin was full of drunken boys three or four nights in each week. The young men that came to see my sisters would come so drunk they could not get off their horses, and we'd have to help them off when they came and help them on when they left. Whiskey was as common as water, and we didn't know any better than to get drunk at everything we did. I was the only one in my family of eight that would never drink. My home was a hell on earth. We cursed and swore and fought, and our home was one of the saddest places in the world. God somehow kept me from doing many things I saw others do. Father and brothers were drunk much of the time. When a young couple was married, whiskey was used. It was used for the different purposes of life. Father died a pauper, of course, and the neighbors had to bury him. If he was saved, it was during the last hour he lived in the world. Nothing on earth is worse than the life of a whiskey-cursed man. Hell is but little worse. So at the age of 60, he had squandered his fortune and had wrecked his life. At one time, he was in the height of prosperity and paid the highest taxes of any man in the community. He was an educated man, but the brainy man will go down as quick as the ignorant man. Sin will wreck any man on the face of the earth. Our home was without religious training. Such a thing as going to church and school was unheard of. Now, reader, you have a faint picture of the mountain life, and it is not overdrawn, for our house was looked upon as one of the nicest places in the community. And we struggled on in that way till the fall of 76, when my mother sold out what little she had there and moved to Texas. We settled in Dallas County near Lancaster, rented a farm, and made a crop on the halves, the man furnishing teams, feed, and farming implements. We made a fine crop, but we did not know how to sell cotton and get the money, for none of us boys could read or write and didn't know how to transact business. The man took advantage of our ignorance and swindled us out of almost everything we made that year. We boys then began to scatter out and leave home. I hired out that winter to a man and worked for him 3 years until the summer of 1880, when God converted me.